Please be advised that this episode of Australian True Crime contains descriptions of graphic violence and is not appropriate for children. This particular episode also contains descriptions of sexual abuse and some language that you might find disturbing.
I realised it was my father-in-law. My father-in-law, who was an Anglican minister, and most beautiful, gentle soul, was on the end of the phone saying, he fucking killed her.
Oh, no.
He fucking killed her. And that was all he could say. He fucking killed her. You've got to tell Jay he fucking killed her. You've got to tell Jay he's fucking killed her.
Tim Klaas Olaf is an ambassador for White Ribbon, which means he campaigns for a future free from violence and abuse for all of us. He carries himself so gracefully, it's hard to believe the level and frequency of violence that's blighted his life.
This is Australian True Crime with Michelle Laurie and Emily Webb. Come with us as we go beyond the news cycle to find out how people become killers, how people become victims, and what happens next.
I met Tim in a church in suburban Brisbane, which was once the domain of his minister father-in-law. Now Tim and his family live in a house on the grounds. In a conversation that delivered many jaw-dropping moments for me, we started off by talking about the coward's punches Tim has received during his career as a sound technician in music venues.
I can't believe how many times you can go into a pub and you can be doing your job, just doing any kind of job. Like, I see so many barmen get attacked, people who'll be playing pool, they hit the ball in the wrong place, somebody will take a pool cue to them. I've even seen people attack people for glassing, you know, how they smash a glass and stick it in their face, and it's like, why do people do that? I still don't get it.
So I take it you've always been pretty anti-violence.
All right. Bit of background. I grew up in a house filled with domestic violence.
Right, okay.
Domestic, mental, emotional, and also sexual abuse. I was lucky enough to be removed and the rest of us when I was 12. Mm. So we went to an orphanage and we spent some time there. And then unfortunately, because they didn't have the resources and they couldn't prove that was the person who was carrying out the rapes, they put us back when I was 14.
How are they supposed to prove that?
Well, we're talking back in the 70s, the early 70s, and I don't think they had a clue back then. My sisters were terrified to speak up because, of course, like, if you ask anybody who's been preyed upon, one of the first things they're going to tell you is that the perpetrator has told them, don't tell anybody because you'll be in more trouble than me.
Yeah.
You'll go to jail. They'll lock you away.
And when the perpetrator is also, I just can't imagine where you go.
Yeah, and some of the people who came into our house were important people, community important people.
And they were committing sexual assault
against minors.
How did that happen?
Well, back in those days, how did anybody prove it?
But was this some kind of circle? This sounds like a pedophile circle.
A group of people, yes.
It is blowing my mind. Wow.
And I'll just put on record that I have to be very careful about what I say and who I say it about.
Of course.
Because even now, has sent letters when I have put something. I put something online once, which just said it's not much better. That was the only line, and he sent a legal letter to me through his solicitor saying that I had to stop my campaign against him. I had mounted a campaign which had put his life in danger. And he also sent around a whole lot of information to White Ribbon and to the school where my children go to say that I wasn't a safe person to be with children. And, of course, those people just went straight away, called me up and said, what is this? This is rubbish. Who is this person? And I said, oh, well. And they went, oh, so the perpetrator is still at it.
Absolutely, because still abusing you.
He doesn't stop. He won't stop. And my two sisters won't speak up because of the same problem. And they're in their 50s. They don't want to talk about it. you can understand, I've been anti-violence all my life. I took up martial arts simply because I wanted to defend myself.
I bet.
And I followed that through, and I can tell you, without having mentoring like that, I wouldn't have turned into a good person. I probably would have gone down the wrong track.
Mm.
But I had some very good, very honourable people who helped direct me in the right way. And I'm so pleased and so grateful for those people.
But how long did it take you to feel comfortable to admit to the world that you had been abused as a child?
I think it was probably around about 25 after I'd tried to commit suicide myself. I got myself together and started doing some more training in the martial arts and worked through a lot of things.
Gosh, that's been powerful in your life, hasn't it? The martial arts, amazing.
I think if you find something that you're passionate about and you focus on that, other things will fall into place.
So would it be fair to say that you made a decision to live at 25 after that suicide attempt was unsuccessful?
Yes.
And then so you had to find out how to deal with things that were making that difficult.
I decided that I had to live every day to the fullest.
Yeah.
Because I knew that a lot of other people were in the same situation. And if I went and disappeared, who would be there to help those people get through that?
Mm.
My own brothers and sisters have experienced similar sorts of things, and we've all had to work our way through those. So it's better that we get on and help others rather than just moping and crying about it.
So, you know, against all odds, you grew up, you grew into a young man who was out and about and getting his life together and working and meeting a lovely lady. How did that work out? Tell me about when you were courting your wife and her family, and they seem like a very nice family is the word I would use.
Oh, fantastic family. I had a young man coming to drop, he was being dropped off to come and work for my company, my sound company, and this woman walks in with him, and I just looked at her and I went, wow. And she looked at me and went, wow. And it was like electricity. And we knew there was something in the way that we looked at each other. And we started seeing each other. And within 2 weeks, I just went to say, I want to ask you something. And she said, the answer's yes.
Oh, how wonderful.
She already knew.
Yeah.
And we came to my mother-in-law's place for lunch the next day, and she got out the camera and started taking pictures, and my wife now, she looked and she said, my mother's never taken a picture of any of my boyfriends. And I said, I think she knows.
Yes, how wonderful.
And she did. She took one look at me and she said, that's my son-in-law. I know that's my son-in-law.
How did that feel coming from your background? This is a religious family, which is like I would find intimidating under any circumstances, to be honest, because I don't come from that background, really. So I would think, oh, God, you've got to mind your P's and Q's and they'll be really judgmental and stuff. But how did it feel?
Well, I can say that Neville, who has passed now, he passed a couple of years ago, he was one of the sweetest guys, and he just took me on as if I was one of his own sons. And Valerie, who's still hanging around and causing trouble for us in the best way, has always been very supportive and very sweet, and she's not a judgmental person at all.
Bless her.
Yeah.
Oh, how wonderful that you married into such a beautiful family. And your wife had siblings?
Yes. Well, and that's where it becomes not so happy, because my sister-in-law, Rachel, she was very, very close to us. She shared our house. She helped raise my two daughters, who are now adults. And we were great mates because she was a chef and I loved to cook, so it was always a bit of competition in the kitchen, always in a very nice, competitive and friendly way. And I guess she probably lived with us on and off over 14 years for probably about half of that time. She'd come and stay with us. And my daughters were very, very close to her. But she started going out with some guy that she'd met at high school after having another relationship break up. And it seemed a little bit odd. And the first time I met the guy, I didn't like him. And I think that's the person I am. I can recognise somebody who is a perpetrator of violence or who likes to control people.
It's interesting you say that, because a lot of victims of sexual abuse will say that abusers can recognise people who've already been victimised somehow.
Yeah.
But also, yes, that victims can have the ability to recognise abusers somehow. How is that, do you think? How does that work?
Oh, it's you can tell that look, you can tell the mannerisms. If you've been abused and you've managed to get away and you've realised that you've been a victim, you can spot all those markers because, I mean, certain people have that look in their eye and it's the way that they talk to you, and that you can tell that they're trying to groom you or trying to put you into a box.
Wow.
Yeah. You do recognise it if you've managed to get away from it before.
Did you say anything to Rachel about what you
Absolutely.
Thought of this dude?
Yeah. The relationship with them, it was a bit temperamental. And a couple of times I went around and I saw the bruises on her arm, and then I saw the bruise on her eye where she'd been punched in the head.
Oh, no.
And her friends and I got together and we rallied and took a truck over there and grabbed all of her stuff and moved around. And then that thing happened where the telephone calls come, lots of telephone calls. Oh, darling, I'm sorry. I didn't mean it. I love you. I love you dearly. I didn't mean to hurt you. I'll never do it again. I'll get some counselling. I promise. I'll go and see a counsellor. I won't take the drugs anymore. They'd send the red razors. She probably got about 20 boxes of razors and chocolates, and all of that sort of stuff just kept going on. And, of course, after about 3 or 4 months, oh, he loves me. It'll be okay. He's promised he's going to be good. And she went back to him. And as she walked out the door, I said, if you go back to him, this is not going to end well for you. And I said, you make sure you keep calling me every day. Anything that goes wrong, I'll be there within a minute. But that relationship then went on for a few years. And she had 3 children with him. And you could also notice that she started disappearing from our life. And you'll see this a lot in domestic violence cases, where the person who's being abused sort of disappears off everybody's radar. You call up, oh, she's not here at the moment. Or, no, she's too busy, she can't talk to you. Or, no, she doesn't want to talk to you at the moment. So you get the feeling that, you know, they're angry with you about something. And the person who's living in that situation will say, oh, who was that? And they'll say, oh, it's nobody. Or such and such isn't coming over today. They can't come over today.
So he starts acting as a gatekeeper between her and
exactly.
everyone who loves her.
And when we talk about it in the domestic violence scenarios, we call this gaslighting. Have you heard that term?
I have, but I've never really understood what it means.
Okay, if you look up a movie from the 1940s, there's a movie called Gaslight.
Yeah.
And it's basically about somebody having control of everything and makes the person who's being abused feel a little bit crazy. And they're not right, and suddenly they believe nobody cares for them. And the only person who cares for them is their abuser. So they start relying on their abuser, and as the abuser hits them, I'm doing this because you made me do this, and they start believing these things. Or you've put that in the wrong place. I put that there, and then you've moved it there, or you've misplaced things. And they start losing sense of reality. And in the end, they end up being totally isolated from everybody else. And that's why it's called gaslighting, control of the gaslight.
Ah, I see. Right, okay.
And
it would be disconcerting, and there's nothing worse than feeling like you're confused and you don't know what's really going on and not trusting yourself.
Yes.
You know?
It gets worse and worse to the point where it's very difficult to tell whether you're sane, whether you're going off the rails. And really it's just that person who's controlling, the gatekeeper, as you say.
Mm.
It carried on like this to the point where I was very concerned. And I would try and get up to the place where they lived, and I'd turn up and it would be a very hostile reception. Or if she'd come and see us, she'd come and see us and she'd be allowed to stay for 20 minutes. And then the phone would ring, where are you? And then there'd be a text, why aren't you back here at the house? Where are the children? And he would keep one child or two children. So she couldn't leave with all three. So I knew something was going on, but I couldn't really prove anything. And then...
And again, that's part of it, isn't it? It's nothing you can put your finger on. When you try and even explain it to other people, it's like, I don't know, it's just the vibe. It's just, you know, because it seems like, well, kids want to stay home all the time and while the other kids in the family go visiting. Like, that's all normal. It's easy stuff to explain away, but when you know in your gut that it's about distancing this person from you and that your relationship with that person has changed and they're being isolated, it's sort of hard to explain that, isn't it, to other people at the time?
Yes, and the other thing too is that you're trying to explain that to somebody, but they'll look at that person and most of those people have a charming nature.
Yeah.
And when they're dealing with other people, they'll seem like the most wonderful person in the entire world. And I refer to person because I've seen women do the same sort of thing with their men. Yeah. It's not exclusive to men on women. There is a certain number of women who will do this to men.
Yeah.
But they'll have the most charming nature. They'll be the hardworking person. They'll be there for everybody else. And you'll think, oh, that person couldn't be like that. No, that's a nice person. But the majority of murders are actually domestic related.
Yeah, and probably follow a campaign of assault or abuse, would you think?
Absolutely. And that's how you can look at this. If you see somebody who's regularly being busted for some sort of domestic abuse, some sort of violence, somewhere in their past, that's where it has led, and it keeps going on to the point where that's the last part of the puzzle. And unfortunately, a lot of people see that these things happen. There's a small amount of violence when they're younger.
Yeah.
And then maybe there'll be one or two reports of the domestic violence situation, and then last thing you see is on TV, he's been charged with murdering. Or she's been charged, yes. A long time ago, I remember hearing somebody say, every one of us is capable of murder.
Yes, yep, I've heard that.
And
we
all have one murder in us. And I think put into a certain circumstances, we are going to be able to get to that point where we'll lose our cool and we'll lift our hand and take a hand to a partner.
I hate to tell you this, but, yeah, I have certainly had periods in my marriage where I've wanted to hurt my husband, and I've thought in the moment, actually, I thought,
did he leave the toilet seat up?
No, it would have been like after, you know, probably would definitely after we became parents, I can tell you that. And then, you know, just
well,
after
see that's
of,
that's adding another level. Yeah. As soon as you add some sort of external force, and when I say drugs and alcohol, we can also include financial hardship.
Yes.
We can include anything that is family related. As soon as you add extra pressures, that's where these things build. It's completely unacceptable.
It is, yes, but I can...
But you can understand that,
yeah,
that is one of those factors which will take them to that point.
I have to confess to, yeah, having reached a level of violence myself in terms of having slapped my husband, which is completely unacceptable, but I have to admit that. I think it's a reasonable thing to admit, don't you? You know what I mean?
Well,
I don't think it's excusable, but what
no,
I'm saying is, if I can sit here and say I have committed an act of domestic violence, I have slapped my husband, which is unacceptable, it feels like that has to be a step forward in the conversation about the issue, that it's, there are levels of it. It's really common. People like me who don't think they could ever commit domestic violence, I have. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, I think all of us are capable.
Yeah.
But the thing is, if we do it, we've got to stop, we've got to take stock,
yeah,
of ourselves.
Yeah.
If you think you've got an issue that will be ongoing, seek help.
Yes.
And I always talk about this sort of thing. If I'm going to speak at a white ribbon event, or I'm talking to students at a school about one punch can kill, or any place where I'm talking about reducing violence, I'll say the moment you feel that you are not in control, seek help.
Yeah.
And there are always plenty of places like 1-800-RESPECT. You can even call Lifeline. You could, and there's men's help lines. There are plenty of different places that you can call up and say, I need some help, and they'll direct you to somebody. There are plenty of free services. And that's the one thing that I've noticed. A lot of people don't want to put their hand up.
Yeah. Well, also I think with women, it's like culturally there's an idea that a woman slapping and punching her husband is cute somehow, is like not serious, it's not violent, it's like sassy and it's in the movies and, you know, I don't know that we take it seriously enough. I mean, if I told my girlfriends that my husband slapped me, they would be around my house with a truck and packing me up and moving me out of there.
And probably a couple of baseball bats.
Yeah.
Too. Yeah.
If he told his friends that I slapped him, I'm sure they'd say, oh, well, that's women for you. She's a crazy bitch or whatever, you know.
They'd probably laugh and say, yes. Oh, you're under the thumb now.
Yes.
Something like that. And, yes, it is cultural. And this is one of the things that we've got to change. Our entire culture is built on this. The man is the strong one.
Yeah.
The woman is the weak one.
After the break, Tim tells us about the murder of his sister-in-law, Rachel, and the profound effects still being felt by his family 9 years later. Later in this episode of Australian True Crime, we'll hear how difficult it can be to ensure children don't end up back in the custody of a father who's killed their mother. But first, Tim takes us through the day of Rachel's murder.
All right, I'm going to take a moment because it's... Well, I'll describe it this way. I was at home. I was doing some stuff in my office, which was in my front room, and the TV was on. And as I went through to get a cup of coffee, I looked at the TV and Max Futcher was on. And I sort of knew him through his brother, who I went to uni with. Well, he's a Channel 10 reporter back in those days. I think he's with another station now, maybe Channel 7. And I sort of paid half a mind to it. And as I had my coffee, I looked and it was a standoff with police. And I thought to myself, oh, that's not a nice situation. I'm glad I'm not there. But you sort of notice it because it was a familiar sort of face.
Yeah.
So I went back to what I was doing. I can't remember, probably doing some inventory or something. And probably an hour later, a phone call came. And I couldn't work out what this person was trying to say. There was this strangled, garbled sort of sound on the phone, and I was trying to work out what it was. And then I realised it was my father-in-law. My father-in-law, who was an Anglican minister and a most beautiful, gentle soul, was on the end of the phone saying, he fucking killed her.
Oh, no.
He fucking killed her. And that was all he could say. He fucking killed her. You've got to tell Joe he fucking killed her. You've got to tell Joe he's fucking killed her. And I'm just, who? What? Who are you talking about? Rachel, he's fucking killed Rachel. And I'm going, what? And that moment where you're in total, what? You just don't believe this. What are you trying to say? And I was just completely in shock. And he's telling me I got to tell my wife. And I'm going, oh, what? I can't tell her that. I can't tell her that. And then my two daughters came across the road from the park and were coming up. And I had to go outside and tell them that their auntie, their other mother, the person who they'd grown up with, had just died. And my two daughters just fell down on the ground screaming. My oldest daughter, who never went a day without a smile on her face, always smiling every single minute of every single day. He was just screaming and yelling. And my little daughter, she was one of those cheeky people who smile constantly. And she's just sitting there still and just tears streaming down her face. And I knew that I had to go, and I had to go and see my wife who was working. My wife's a nurse who does palliative care.
Oh,
so,
wow.
So she's looking after people every day who have got dementia and who are passing to the next world. And I've called up and I've spoken to the manager of the place. I said, look, I'm going to come there. I've got to tell Jo something terribly tragic. I can't tell you what it is. I don't want her to hear it from you. It's got to come from me. I get there and Jo's waiting out front, and she just took one look at me and she started crying and she said, what's wrong? What's wrong? She knew something was terribly wrong. She thought it was her mother or her father.
Wow. Yeah.
Because you kind of expect your parents to have a heart attack or when they're older.
Mm.
You're used to that. You accept something like that. But the moment I told her it was Rachel, she was on the ground screaming and crying, and I couldn't move her off the ground for 20 minutes.
Mm.
And we got back to the house, and that night was probably the worst night.
Mm.
Because you can't reconcile with inside yourself. Somebody who you know, somebody who is so vibrant and alive, is suddenly missing. Mm-hmm. And you just fully expect that the phone's going to ring and, I'm here, or they're going to walk in the door. But when somebody's life is taken this way, and I speak to a lot of people who have lost their loved ones in similar circumstances, none of us know how to deal with it.
No.
It short circuits something in your brain. And we all sound a little bit insane because we're still trying to put that into a box, and there's no box for it. So you spend, you know, three or four months just trying to get your head around the fact that somebody's life has just been snuffed out in an instant. And all those other things that come with that death. We have a term, it's called the ripple effect.
Mm.
And a lot of your listeners, and perhaps you have heard of this,
yeah.
It's where somebody dies and it's like somebody throws a huge big rock into a pool of water, and then those waves and ripples that come out hit everybody all the way to the outside of the pool. Because it doesn't just, it's not the person dying, it's the three little kids. They're left without parents. Those three little kids also witnessed that murder. They are broken for the rest of their lives. No matter what we do, yeah, we can get them close, but there'll always be a little part of them that is broken. It's my two daughters who will always be a little bit broken. My wife, who is completely broken. You didn't see my wife there, did you?
No.
She's inside there, she's hiding.
Yeah.
She would never talk to you.
Yeah.
I had a friend here last night. My wife locked herself in the bedroom.
Okay.
We're talking 9 years.
Does she still work?
She still works. Yeah. She'll go to work. She'll look after people who are
dying. Look after other people. But yeah.
And that's her therapy.
Yeah.
But she didn't work for 3 months. I couldn't get her out of bed.
So 9 years later, she still struggles socially.
She still struggles socially. Can't talk. She can't go out and see her old mates because she's always afraid that they're going to start talking about this situation. My father-in-law, his way of dealing with it was he hit the bottle.
Oh, no.
And he drank himself to death. And God rest his soul, because, I mean, Neville's presence is probably still in here.
In this church, yeah. So this was his church for how many years?
15 years.
So obviously such a good man, such a generous man, and that's how his life ended.
And he just did, he counselled everybody else about death,
yep.
But couldn't deal with it himself.
Mm. Are you prepared to talk about just a little bit about the children in terms of, like, how has adopting Rachel's children Has that helped you guys push forward, do you think, because you're responsible for these young people?
Oh, I'll talk about it.
Yeah.
Okay, hard on marriage. Adopting somebody else's children is hard on marriage.
Yeah.
Hard on the family dynamic. You can imagine my younger daughter suddenly feeling like she'd been shifted over.
Yeah.
No, and she demanded that they not call me dad.
Oh, okay.
And when it came down to the sentencing for this person, he went down the Mental Health Act. So it's called Section 16 in Queensland. And he managed to convince one of the panel of four psychiatrists that he was crazy at the time. So the Mental Health Tribunal had to err on the side of caution and accept that he could have been crazy. So he didn't stand trial for murder. He stood trial for manslaughter with the proviso of Section 16. So when it finally came to sentencing, he only got 9.5 years. Now, when it comes to federal law about children, the children cannot be released from the care of the parent unless they receive a sentence more than 10.5 years. So technically, he murders his wife, goes to jail, and with 9.5 years, released on probation at 5.5 years, goes down to the school and picks up the kids, takes them home.
Oh my God.
Because the state law doesn't marry up with federal law.
Is that what happened? Did he get out of jail and go and get the kids?
No, because the moment that happened, we had already picked up the children because we'd already been registered as foster parents. And we went, within 24 hours, we had the children in our possession. Department of Child Safety had said that it would be a good idea for the children to be with us while he was, at the time, in jail, awaiting trial on murder. They thought it would be the best place for the children to be because there was no one else who was mutually acceptable. We had to prove we were good people. We had to have police checks, background checks. We had to have people come over and sit in the house with us for hours at a time and watch us interacting with the children. And this wasn't on one occasion. This was on several occasions. We had to have letters supporting our bid for to relieve the children from him, and we had to get those from upstanding people in the community, and that ended up being about 20 different affidavits signed by people. And when we finally got to the end, the magistrate looked over her glasses at us and said, "I don't know how you've done this." She said, "Most people give up." So I think of all of those other families, how many other families go through this every year? If we're talking maybe 20 murders in the southeast area who have to have the same sort of thing where the father goes down Section 16 and he'll be out in 9 years and he can pick up the kids, and the parents from the other side are desperately trying to save those children. How many of these people are having to mortgage their houses and go into debt for the rest of their lives just so that they can keep those children safe? It's a terrible thought.
It is indeed. But before we sign off for this week's episode, we want to share with you Tim's advice on the very awkward topic of speaking to someone you believe may be living with and perpetrating domestic violence.
There's not many men involved in the domestic violence advocacy world to the extent that you are. You know, the point, I was reading some articles about you today, and somebody made the point that they were at a march or at an event and there were like 200 women and there were, I think, 3 men, of whom you were one. And women talk about this all the time. It's women's problem because we're the ones who are most often murdered. But wouldn't it be great if we had more male allies to fight this scourge?
Oh, you're preaching to the converted. I go to these meetings sometimes and I'll look at and you're right, 97% women, 3% male.
Yeah.
And I'll go, "Ladies, I love you all, but I'm not talking to you. Sorry, there's 3 of you guys and I'm talking directly to you."
Yeah.
because that is the hardest thing, to get men engaged with this problem.
Yep.
It's not a woman's problem.
Yes. So what do you say to a man who suspects that his mate, a bloke at work, you know, belts his missus? What do you suggest he says to that man? Because we know that the man's going to be very defensive. I'd be scared to say to a man, hey, I think you hit your wife and you shouldn't, and try and start that conversation. How do you start that conversation?
Though I was listening to somebody talk about gossip the other day, mm-hmm. and how if you talk and gossip about things in a particular way, you can reinforce good or bad.
Oh, yeah. Never thought of it that way.
So when we say stand up and speak out at White Ribbon, there's a reason why we say that. If you're standing up and you're saying to your friend, oh, domestic violence is terrible, we shouldn't be doing it, can you imagine if that was your sister or your mother? Would you let your mother get hit that way? No, you wouldn't. Would you let your sister? What about your daughter? If you found out your daughter was being beaten up by her boyfriend, you'd want to go around and take, you know, the shotgun to him. Mm. You start in that sort of vein.
Yeah, interesting.
Because if we can get everybody to start thinking about that and talking about how bad domestic violence is and how you would feel if you were the person receiving that.
Yeah.
Put yourself in a woman's shoes.
Yeah.
And imagine how you would feel if you're stuck at home, you've got no finances, you've got no way of getting out of the house, and somebody comes home and you're terrified to hear the sound of the door and wondering whether he's drunk or not, or he's high on ice, are you going to get bashed, or maybe he got fired at work or somebody put him down at work, so you're going to cop a punch in the face because it's your fault. No, it's not your fault. A woman's just the punching bag in these circumstances. It's the man who has the problem.
And I think finally the conversation is turning from why doesn't she just leave to why doesn't he just stop punching her, don't you
exactly.
think? It's finally turning around.
I try to explain this to some people. How do you leave somebody who has control of your finances, who has control of your car, who has the house locked, who has your mobile number so he knows where you're going, or has the children.
Yeah.
Has the pets.
Yeah.
If I go back to Rachel's situation, she used to go to work. Mm-hmm. He'd follow her in the car, make sure she went to work. If she was too late getting home, he'd be there. Or he'd be texting her, you're not home, you should have been home 20 minutes ago. Who are you with? Mm. All of this sort of crazy stuff. And there are thousands of women who live through that every single day. And so we shouldn't be saying, why didn't he leave her? You're right. It should be, why didn't he just stop hitting her and get some help?
Yeah.
Or why didn't he leave?
Yeah.
If you can't control yourself, walk out the door.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's what I want to see. I want to see more guys telling their mates, if you've got a problem with anger, walk out the door. Go to the gym, punch the bag in the gymnasium. Don't punch your wife.
A few thank yous this week. Thank you firstly to the Queensland Homicide Victims Support Group, who helped me get in touch with Tim. Thank you also to Variety. Tim wanted to make sure we acknowledged them and thanked them for the financial assistance they've given the family. And thank you so much for downloading this episode of Australian True Crime. Please tell your friends about it. And if you've got time, next time you're surfing around on Facebook, maybe like our Facebook page and share some posts with your networks to help people find our podcast.